It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show.
It's really about ethics and bootstrap paradox information transfer.
Oh, we are going to have so many fucking arguments today.
Wow.
We are going to have arguments, Paul. Like, already I can just tell. The whole podcast is going to be Paul and I talking about time and paradoxes.
So we're talking about the film Interstellar.
I'm Sean.
I'm Rachel.
I'm Mike.
And I'm Paul.
Okay. All right. I guess we got to do this thing. So Interstellar. I've seen it twice because I love it. So it should be – does somebody want to describe what it's about and then we'll dive into general reactions?
So I'll take a stab at describing what it's about. Basically, Earth is being destroyed by an eco-disaster, so everybody decides that – well, not everybody. The underground remnants of NASA decide that it's time to finally leave the Earth, so construct a exploration ship to go through a wormhole that's mysteriously appeared out by Saturn so that we can see beautiful pictures of Saturn and go out exploring into a system that has a giant black hole in it, which I was a little confused about, and then to find habitable worlds that we can try to move humanity to, and then it just gets very complicated from there.
That seems fairly close, yeah.
I was going to say, did we want it to get more spoilery? Because I could get like way more spoilery, but that seems the good, you know, little synopsis.
Well, we can put up a spoiler wall later when we want to get into maybe more specific things, such as like maybe the ending, which I suspect we're all going to want to talk about. But for now, why don't we stick to mostly non-spoilery, at least, you know, you can spoil anything that's in the trailer. We'll go with
that. Okay. Because I was going to say, what I love so much about the movie is actually its many themes about betrayal, but that's all very spoilery.
Okay. Well, we'll get into that in a little bit later. So why don't we start with general reactions, and we'll just start with you, Rachel, since you're the first up on my screen.
So I got to see it like the first night it was available on the early release in 35mm. So it was gorgeous. And I fucking love this movie. I was aware that there are some problems with it, which we will no doubt exhaustively discuss later. But in general, I mean, it made me cry. It just it was a beautiful movie, kind of like about loneliness and betrayal and man's relationship with the wider with you know, the vastness of space and humanity's relationship with the Earth and interpersonal relationships, which is really kind of like my jam. So I loved it. And then the one thing I want to like mention right now, just because this movie geeked me out so hard on it, is that it was done with a lot of practical effects, which, you know, Chris Nolan is really known for anyway. But I get Empire Magazine, and I was reading their article about it. And apparently, like, a lot of the stuff, like, when they're on the ship and, say, looking out onto starscapes, that was not actually done with green screen. What they had is they built this, you know, like, the ship set, which was on all these hydraulic rams so that they could move it around and shit because, you know, Chris Nolan. And they had white screens around, and they actually projected all of the starscapes onto the white screens. So a lot of those shots were not even done in post-production. They were just like completed when, you know, the primary phase of shooting was done, because the actors were like literally looking out and seeing what we saw.
That is super cool.
I know, right? And like, so like all the reflections on the helmets were right, and yeah.
That's really cool, because like that's the thing that I really like, because obviously there's a lot of CG'd stuff in terms of, I guess, what's being projected,
well,
like
yeah,
the
obviously.
Space stuff, Gargantua, and all that kind of stuff. But yet using real sets and using real set pieces, for me, I find that much more interesting than just to pick on an obvious example. Like you go to something like Michael Bay where it's got these big giant CG robots, which are cool, but then you get to that point where they're just it's too fake, right? Because it's so CG'd, it's so much CG, or like the Star Wars prequels where it's so much CG that it sort of it pulls me out of the story. I get to that point where I'm out.
And they don't have any weight inside of the narrative universe, since the actors aren't seeing them and really reacting to them in a real way, or they are actually moving around the universe. They feel, and if done poorly and or done to excess, like say Michael Bay or Star Wars, they just feel like they're just images rather than actual objects that exist in that cinematic universe.
Yeah, like an example, just to go with the Star Wars example, if you look at say Return of the Jedi, when you have these massive battles with all of these models, they built these fucking models and they had these huge space battles, right, with these things that are physical, like real objects. And then you go to, say, Revenge of the Sith, when you get to that, you get a similar battle scene in space with the, like, early version of the Star Destroyers and all of that stuff, but it's so flashy and it's so, you can just feel that it's not real.
Video gamey.
It's video gamey, yeah, like really, really high quality, but at the same time it's like, but I know if I can't, it's not a physical object. Whereas like that Star Destroyer's, like in the first Star Wars, you see that Star Destroyer for the first time. It's so detailed and beautiful because it's an object. In the same way with this film, I love that they used a lot of real set pieces. They probably filmed in Iceland because duh. Yeah.
Everyone is these days.
I love that stuff. I love practical effects being used as much as humanly possible because I hate CG festivals. I can't stand them. They're so boring to me. So I'm sorry. I totally just jumped off of on Rachel's point because apparently I'm not alone on this podcast, and
no,
I'm so
I mean,
happy.
it's such an important point, and I mean that was, if nothing else, that was one of the things that made Inception like such a cool, just trippy movie, was that so much of that weird stuff was done with practical effects, and then he did it again with a space movie, and I'm like, maybe we're finally looping around to where we're going to see more practical effects again. Because yeah, I'm also I understand the budgetary reasons to do CG, and also it kind of offers an opportunity to try to make something much more grandiose and do things that can't easily be done with practical effects. But I think that it's kind of made, it's taken away from the art in a way, and it has made it feel a lot less like real. And then the other thing I just wanted to mention, because you know I'm talking about special effects apparently, is the fact that the most accurate model of a black hole ever created, and they modeled the black hole for the movie, and they actually did, you know, the scientist who wrote the equations for modeling the black hole is going to get some papers out of it.
Sweet. All right, well, why don't we jump to Mike to get your general reactions, Mike?
I really loved all the, ditto everybody on the practical effects. There are some of those long shots in front of the planets or in front of the other places where they go to that were simply breathtaking. And my inner 5-year-old science lover was just going the whole time through some of those. And that is something that no amount of my criticism for some of the world building in Act 3 can take away. So I'm utterly delighted by a lot of the visuals. I thought that the kind of climate change premise was scarily viable in some of the ways, and it's good to see some of those kind of self-defeating prophecy type of stories making it to the really big screen. And I utterly adored the robots.
Oh
yes!
My god, yes.
Oh,
I
the
wanted
robots
my own
TARS.
Yes, I want a TARS.
Yes. I love, okay, can I just say, this isn't a big spoiler, but that moment when he first learns that he's got a humor setting, and he's like, it's like, I'll tell you about it when I shoot your ass out the airlock.
Yeah. I love that you're all going to be slaves on my robot colony.
Yeah.
Like, it's great because this is such a serious film, and then you get these just little tiny moments of brevity, which I just love it. Those are great. So I agree with you, Mike. Robots. We should have many.
That's all for me.
Yeah. I also love that Case says Tars talks enough for the both of us.
Yes. Yep.
Case is the serious robot and Tars is the goof. It's good. They're Nolan's R2-D2 and C-3PO. So, I'm sorry. Anyway, Paul, general reactions.
Well, I saw this movie on a 70mm quasi-IMAX screen. So when this movie gets to space, I was blown away. And I had lots of geek out moments. Saturn, that beautiful shot of Saturn in the silhouette. Oh, my God. My heart went pitter-patter when we see that early on in the movie. And, of course, not even the equation surrounding the black hole, just the absolute gorgeousness of that black hole. It's like, this is what that Disney movie should have been. I need to go watch The Black Hole again. But that'll probably get into deeper into the podcast comparing the two movies that way. I Mike already mentioned Tars. I like Tars a lot. I like Feature and Bug that Nolan likes to bring back members from previous movies and put them in this serious one. So I was good to see Anne Hathaway and Michael Caine again. Because they apparently are part of Nolan's little movie club. There's silence. Wow.
I think we were very much in agreement. I'm really surprised right now that so far everyone seems to have liked the movie.
No, I'm holding back.
Oh, I'm going to kill you later, Mike.
This is what the podcast is made of, Sean. It's going to be great.
All right, well, my general reactions... Well, my cat does something he's not supposed to be doing. What are you doing? Stop it. Well, I'm still trying to decide whether or not this is Christopher Nolan's magnum opus. Because I... What?
I sure hope not.
Hey, now.
You be quiet. I hope not. You be quiet. This is my moment.
I would say I would agree that I hope not in the sense that he damn well better keep making movies that are, you know, as awesome as this and Inception. So. Okay.
Thus far, then. I haven't decided because I pretty much love the film in almost everything. And I would probably rank it easily in his top three best films that he's ever done. And I can't decide if it's number one because I loved everything about this film with some minor caveats of things that I'm sure we'll agree on later that are somewhat that didn't quite work. But overall, I love the epic nature of this film. I love that it is, for the most part, scientifically accurate, at least to a line. Because Kip Thorne, who was their like local physicist dude, whatever you want to call him, consultant, basically told Nolan that I will not work on this film if you are just going to go like do whatever the frick you want and just violate all the laws of physics anytime you like because it's convenient for the story. I will only work on it as long as you follow physics up to like the line at which physics can answer. And then everything beyond that has to be like reasonable leaps. And so what we ended up with is a film that is probably pretty damn scientifically accurate up to that point at which it takes the little leap. And the leap that it takes is still based on theoretical physics and quantum physics and those kinds of things, but is certainly a little bit out there, which I also appreciate. So I love that this is scientifically pretty accurate to a point. There are like a bazillion and a half posts on interstellar science. There's even a book by Kip Thorne on interstellar science. So if you want to go look at it, go for it. So I love that. I love Matthew McConaughey in this, who... he won't get an Oscar for his performance, but he should, but he won't because it's a science fiction movie and the Academy is completely biased against genre fiction for reasons that just don't make no sense to me because his performance is exceptional in this. I mean, it's heartbreaking to watch this man sort of fall apart towards the end of the film for reasons we'll get into later. Yeah, so watching that was brilliant. The acting was really well done. The visuals were great. I loved the story. I love that it also is optimistic because there are not enough science fiction movies that are really terribly optimistic. There are a lot of science fiction movies which are very pessimistic, where the victories that come at the end are fairly small potatoes in the grand scheme of things. And in this case, it's a film where basically the message is that, you know, humanity may die in terms of on Earth, but, you know, we can go out there. We could solve our problems. We can get out there and find a solution. And I love that optimism, that belief that even in the darkest of times that we still are pushing that envelope, trying to find something more. So I see Mike has a hand because I have rambled on about how much I love this movie. So go on, Mike.
Yeah, I definitely ditto you on optimism and on the pro humanity goes to space angle that the film takes. Mm. I think it's interesting that if we look at this film and we look at Gravity, probably the two biggest splash space-based SF films in their respective years, Guardians of the Galaxy being mostly along a separate axis for this conversation, that one of them was so, for me, Gravity was very much a holy crap, space is scary, we don't belong there. And yeah. Interstellar is, it is inevitable that humanity must go to the stars. And for those to be such a clear counter argument to each other.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. Paul?
Yeah, I just want to highlight what Mike was saying. I was thinking about Gravity. I was watching so much. It's like Gravity keeps hammering that theme. Space is not the place where we belong. We belong back on Earth. Destroys every bit of Earth technology in low Earth orbit just to emphasize the point and just stick us back on Earth where we started. Where Zinzel says we shouldn't only go to the stars. We need to go to the stars. So I really appreciated. I mean, some of the themes in this movie hammer maybe a little too didactically, but I agree with the didacticism, so I'm kind of torn that way. It's like, I agree with you, even if you're hitting me over the head with this.
Rachel?
Yeah, and I mean, one thing I would say is, like, they both had a similar theme about that space is a completely inhospitable environment for life. I mean, That is, I thought, done very clearly in Interstellar as well. But I think the difference between the two movies was that it was, with Interstellar, it was like space is not a place for living so much, but we need to get out there anyway because we cannot just stay on this planet. We need to go out and, you know, colonize other worlds, though of course at the end things change, but I'm not going to say anything, you know, about like the inhospitable nature of space, but I'm not going to say anything because spoilers. But I mean, I thought like there's a lot of comparisons that go on between this movie and actually 2001.
Yeah,
which my friend Sarah would eat my face for saying this, but frankly I like this movie better than 2001, except for the fact that there were a few things I could have done hold on, don't you even think about doing this, cat. Nope. Get down.
My cat is the only one that's allowed to interrupt podcasts.
Yeah, Tanger, you hear that? But there were some things that, like 2000, that Interstellar would have been better off explaining less, kind of the way 2001 didn't, you know, over-explain things. But, you know, I thought it had that same epic feel about that space is very, very big and humans are very, very tiny and very, very fragile. But at the same time, you know, are capable of surviving because, gosh darn it, we're pretty clever. We're pretty clever, which actually, I don't know. In Gravity was about kind of space being very inhospitable, but I would also say that the main character in Gravity also survived because, you know, gosh darn it, we're kind of clever little apes.
Okay, so I got to jump in. I'm just going to put the spoiler wall now. Because okay. The thing that Rachel, you didn't want to mention, that we just have to talk about it now because we can't have this conversation and then like skip that part. So anybody who doesn't want the movie, any part of the movie spoiled for them, this is the point in which we're going to start getting into actual plot details and things, including stuff that happens at the end, which I'm going to talk about right this second. So
okay.
The thing that you mentioned, you know, that the comparison between Gravity and Interstellar. In Gravity, we're shoved back down to the Earth. Everything in space, as Mike mentioned, right? Basically, half that shit is destroyed, right? All of the manned-based stuff, at least, is destroyed, right? The International Space Station gets thrown off. All of that stuff, gone. In Interstellar, While space is still presented as very dangerous and in many respects inhospitable, at the end of that movie, we solve the equation, the problem that has defined half of this film, or well, almost half of this film. We solve that problem and manage to put a giant rotating, basically like giant space station for people to live on in space, in orbit around Saturn. So the idea being that even the inhospitability of space is something that we can transcend, that we can find a solution for, to a certain degree at least. I mean, it's certainly a temporary solution at the end of the film, because they can't live there forever. They have to get to the planet, Edmonds. But at the same time, that optimism, that idea that you know, that the human mind can solve even something as violent and mean as space, that we can solve that. It's like one of the most optimistic points of this film, that even something like that can be overcome. And for those that are a little bit confused, and you're still listening because you don't care about spoilers, there are two plans that are presented in the film. The first plan is we're going to go through this wormhole. There are a bunch of possibly habitable worlds. Find one that can be habitable, and then you can either put people there in terms of like a surrogacy system with like fertilized embryos and like a blah blah vat and all this kind of stuff. Or the Michael Caine's character is trying to solve a gravity equation which will allow the movement of a space station from the Earth into space. So that's fun. Yay. So there we go. And I see Paul had a hand, so I'm going to let you go to it, Paul.
Yeah, right. 2001 is the other movie that I was thinking of as I was watching this because, sure. Well, the movie does turn surreal and I should say non-scientific, spiritual and weird once he goes into in beyond which we don't know. I mean, 2001, it's the monolith here, it's the black hole. The other interesting thing I want to note is, and it's probably a coincidence, that at the end we get a space station around Saturn. I'm presuming that space station is probably in close proximity to that wormhole, and that's why they put it there. Yeah. Maybe it reminded me of, well, Deep Space Nine, with a space station that's moved next to a wormhole.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Well, it's a spaceport. It's right next to a port.
Yeah, and it's not the only one.
Yeah, they imply there are other space stations floating around.
Right, because it would be somewhat sad if that was the only one, because that cannot sustain much of the population of Earth, like maybe a few thousand people on that one. So there must be many other space stations. I mean, granted, a lot of humanity's dead.
Well, they say his daughter's coming from another one, so we know there's at least two.
Yeah, my thing is, I suspect there are dozens. I suspect there are dozens because she's got that massive family, and they can't all live on the same one. Like they probably all go to different space stations. So, yeah.
And I think it's stated in the movie that a lot of these are being built at some point.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it makes sense. I mean, it's certainly not a quick process to build a space station.
Yeah, because we're assuming like a good 40, 50 plus years between the last time we see the Jessica Chastain version of Murphy and when we see her at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think we all pretty much are in agreement about the optimism. I love it. I love feeling good. I went and saw Big Hero 6 after I watched this. So it was like a mountain of happy because that's also super positive. But
I was just going to say the movie I saw immediately after Interstellar was Nightcrawler.
Wow.
Jesus. Yeah.
Okay. Right, Mike?
So I wanted to raise some questions about the world building that perhaps other folks had different experiences of. One, I had two problems. One was a personal problem in that Coop seemed to put 90% of his effort into paying attention to one of his two children, and that seems really squicky to me because he's just spent so much more time reaching out to Murph and worrying about her, and that his farmer, his son, who was, as far as he could tell, content with being a farmer, was fine, and therefore mostly didn't need any other attention. And that really rubbed me the wrong way.
Yeah, I would agree. I agree with you there. I think the film tries to put a lot of attention on the tension between them, because you've seen it in the trailers. I mean, he has to leave his children behind, and Murph, being the young daughter, doesn't want to accept it and doesn't for like 20 years, right? She holds it against him for all that time. I think that Nolan was trying to present, because there's that moment when we see the videos after they go to is it Miller's planet, and they lose all of that time. And he comes back and he sees videos, and his son has decided that his father's dead and to let him go. I think that was the moment which the film was trying to suggest that maybe that he's there's nothing he can do about his son. But at the same time, it does present a kind of coldness, because as you've noted, right, he really doesn't seem to care too much about his son. And I'm trying to understand why. There's some reason there why he's so much colder to his son than to his daughter. Maybe someone else has a perspective on that. So maybe Paul?
I do, actually. I as I was watching this and seeing how the son was shunted in favor of the daughter, and the son is almost superfluous to me, one of the thoughts I had, and this I'll thank Rachel and Stina and people like that and in the community, is in most movies that would be reversed. It would be the son who wants to be the astronaut and the physicist, and the daughter would be the farm, and the daughter would get short shrift. That's the way movies usually run. It was strange to see it reverse this. I'm seeing the daughter be the scientist, the intellectual hero, the one that has the relationship with the father, and the son getting short shrift. And I still think it's wrong. I mean, the son's role in this movie is almost superfluous. You could take it out and not really change this film in any real substantial way. And that's really bad world building. And I think we've kind of interrupted all of Mike. But Mike said he had two problems with world building. We've kind of harped on one. But yeah, I thought in most movies it would be the son to be the scientist, the daughter would be the farmer, and the daughter would get short shrift, because women characters in films, we all know that. They reversed that for a change, and it was kind of striking to see the son get such short shrift. And I think it's because of the unexpected gender change there.
Okay. We'll go back to Mike after Rachel has her thought on this. That way you can give us your second point, Mike. So, Rachel, go.
One thing that did strike me actually was the fact that, it was the daughter that actually got all the attention, and it wasn't just because like some guy wanted to bang her or something, which is very unusual in movies. But I do want to say, I mean, I think part of it's a screen time issue, but I have, you know, even personally observed families where I don't think it's that like Coop does not love his son, but you do see this family dynamic where like one of the kids, and it's normally like a two parent family where, you know, it's not quite so pronounced, where it's like one of the kids just connects on a kind of a different level with their parents because they share the same interests, or because that child is much more emotionally needy than the other one. And it doesn't necessarily mean that, say, the other kid doesn't need dad and doesn't want dad's love, but it's just the other kid, you know, the first child like kind of needs them so much more. And so the thing is, I don't feel like it was unrealistic in world building. I actually thought it was a very interesting family dynamic that got set up there, because basically the situation as I understood it is you had Murph, and then you had the son who, I mean, if nothing else, this poor character, like I can't even remember his name, but then again, for once the daughter gets attention, so that was pretty awesome. But so Murph was the one who connected with her father on this level where, you know, they're both scientists. They're both really into the same things, where the son's just kind of like, that's not his thing. He's not really into it. The son, you know, if anything, he's more like the kid of the grandfather where that's where all of his interests were. And then the son was such a self-contained person. And you do get kids like that where he doesn't seem to need so much from Coop, even though he really does need the parental love, that it becomes easier for Cooper to just be like, oh, he's okay. I'm going to pay attention to Murph because she's a much more needy child. And like I said, it's not fair to the kid, but I have observed families like this in the wild. So I don't feel like it's an unrealistic part of the world building.
Well, it's a thing that made me dislike Coop as a hero, which problematized things and undermined then what for me was the ultimate thesis statement of the film in terms of basically I lean toward the reading that love is the fifth dimension, and that then the love as an attractor resistor is kind of the major force that fixes things, so that you have a character who seems as drawn to one of his children as he is a kind of has a zero charge toward his other child.
Well, I don't know. I do think that it's fair to say that Coop is not a particularly good parent.
No, he's really not.
He's not, and I think it becomes very clear in one of the earliest scenes in which they're at the dinner table and they're having breakfast, right? And the grandfather's there, and his daughter is talking about having a ghost in her bedroom. We may talk about that later, right? And his first reaction is just to dismiss what she says and like move on, and the grandfather has to like give them the eye, and it's like, oh, right, I have to actually be a parent. I can't just tell my kid she's a dumbass, right? I have to actually explain, like, you know, if we're going to do this, like, where you do this ghost thing, then you need to go in there and you need to conduct an experiment, right, and present your findings, and we'll do it this way, like little science people. Like, I think there's a nature to which we're, or a degree to which we're presented Coop as being somebody who was never supposed to be the at-home dad figure and is just fucking terrible at it and is trying and loves his kids, but doesn't like he doesn't know how to do it. He doesn't know how to sort of give his kids the attention they need. I mean, after all, his first reaction when he goes to the school and they tell them that his son is not good enough to go to school, right? He's basically like, well, you should send him to school. But then he doesn't like push his son to actually do anything, because his son actually likes farming, so he doesn't seem to know exactly what to do with his son except to just sort of like, okay, that's you like that, you're good at it. His son seems to have his head pretty much on his shoulders, at least until he becomes an older man and then he becomes psycho, but we'll get to that later. So Rachel, last thought on this maybe, and then maybe we should go to Mike's second point.
Yeah, I mean I do definitely get the impression that Coop, yeah, if nothing else, the entire time that Cooper is on Earth, he's just basically a guy who is in a situation that's not where he wants to be, because he's this, you know, engineer astronaut guy who's being forced to be a farmer, and he's pretty miserable, and he's not in you know, a good spot. So, yeah, I got the impression that he wasn't that thrilled about being the stay-at-home dad either. Like the grandfather was way more into being a dad than he was, which negatively reflects on the character, but then again I thought that made him interesting as opposed to like he's an astronaut and the best dad ever and so
the flaws make him a little bit more in depth, give him depth.
Yeah, well, and I gotta say, like, the moment that actually made me love Coop despite all of his flaws was when he went into school. And yeah, there was that thing where they were like, well, your son can't be, you know, your son's not going to go to school. And you could tell Cooper was like, well, you know, hey, what the fuck? But at the same time, like, the son's totally cool with it. It's his decision. But then when they get into talking about the thing with Murph where, you know, she brought in the textbook and the moon landing, and then Cooper was just like, oh, well, I'm going to take her to a baseball game.
I love that moment. That moment made me so happy.
I was just sitting there going, oh my god, I hope Phil Plate sees this, because he'll just, like, cry with joy.
All right, Mike, let's get to that second point of yours.
Well, and luckily, the second point flows right out of that. The notion that, and this, I'm hoping that the film is meant to regard this as utter bullcrap from the educators. The world doesn't need more engineers, we need more farmers. And the notion that we don't get to see anyone outside of NASA working on how to make the crops more robust. There's no discussion about overall efforts to kind of make more robust all of their crop options. So there's a lot of that kind of slightly wider screen world building that is just not there for me. And I get that most of what the film is trying to do has nothing to do with that. But if that chunk of the film is going to be a useful self-defeating prophecy about here's how things go really poorly with climate change and with kind of the using up of our natural resources, it really was missing a big chunk in there for me.
Okay. So a couple things. So I can see why people might find that moment in the textbook, like, that doesn't make any sense. How did we get to this point? I took it as that what had happened, and there are a couple lines that suggest this, that there had been pretty brutal, nasty wars over resources at some point, and that there isn't actually that much left of humanity. I mean, there's still quite a few people, but there aren't the 7 billion mouths to feed anymore. We're down to far less. And so resource wars are less a concern now. It's now about food resources. And then on the food itself, there is that moment when we're in Michael Caine's facility, right, Dr. Brand's facility, when he's showing us them doing all of these quarantine tests on corn and plants, right? My understanding, and I don't think the film maybe explains this, it sort of leaves this for you to figure out, is that what we're presented is a blight that is a super blight. In the same way that, you know, you're getting those antibacterial resistant bacteria in hospitals, that you basically just have to cut the flesh off. You can't treat it. You just cut the flesh off and try to regrow the flesh and hope you got it all out. In the same way that the blight, that they haven't figured out what to do. And we're at a point where I think a lot of the people in the upper echelons, as evidenced by the fact that NASA is this now secret organization, right? They've basically decided, yeah, we're fucked. Earth is effed. We can't solve these problems. We have to get off as quickly as possible. And that's our only solution because humanity's dead, right? At least in terms of humanity as we understand it. And I see Paul really, really wants to talk. So why don't you talk?
I want to agree with both of you and harp in on this. Mike is right. The world building in this aspect is underwritten. I had to headcanon a lot of things. Some of the things that you were talking about, Sean, clearly something has really wrecked. Not even going to the bite yet, really wrecked the total population of the Earth because this feels like the world has contracted in a severe way. Because remember, look at the baseball game, for example. The grandfather comments, so who are these guys? And they're wearing Yankee uniforms, but they're clearly not the New York Yankees. So it's clearly the world has contracted in a big way. We've turned away from science and where we have this retrenchment of trying to survive. And I think you're right, Sean. This blight is not something we're even looking to solve. We're just looking to survive. It's like they only have corn left. And it's like, who eats popcorn in a baseball game? So, but the movie tries to hand wave all that with a couple of things about the textbook, but it doesn't flesh that in. I had to flesh it in my own mind, tried to build up, okay, what is this world like? What is the rest of the world like? And we don't see that, but it's clear that the world has shrunk and it's at a much poorer pace. And that's why we have to go to the stars, because humanity is dying out and the world is not what it once was. And we need farmers because we're regressing. It's almost like one of those looking back at the golden age, and now we're the world is going further and further into ruin. But it doesn't really. I mean, the whole front of this movie goes too long before we get to space as is. But the movie doesn't do enough to really explain how much that was. Also, consider the drone that they shoot down. Apparently, that drone had been up for years, from we hear dialogue in the movie. So it's clear that. Yeah, we're sliding back from a technological high point.
And yeah, for me, this was a whole science fiction trilogy as one movie.
Yeah, that I could see how you do that. They compress a lot, especially into the world building of I mean, almost like a Scott Ziegler Seed sort of universe in some ways.
Yeah.
Okay, well, here's where I'm going to make some disagreements.
Okay.
So get prepared for a fight. Mike, you got your fists up?
Yep.
Nah, this isn't actually that kind of disagreement. We'll get to that later. here's where I don't necessarily agree that this is like a science fiction trilogy packed into one film. I actually think that what we're being presented is this is the world at this particular moment. We're not going to have a conversation about where we were except by way of hints, because that's like nobody sits around and like essentially the only way we're going to get the answers that you guys really want is if there's a moment where somebody says, as you know, Bob, right, in the old times, this is what happened and then this happened and this, like where we get a history lesson. And I think what's more interesting is to have a lot of the questions, like how did we get to this point, not quite answered, but you have to actually put in, you have to fill in the blanks yourself based on the visual or verbal clues. So we don't actually know how we got to this point. We just know that this is the point at which we're at, and we know that in the dialogue that we're presented, you know, some of the things that stick out are little bits of evidence, because that's how people talk anyway. I mean, like, if you think about it, like what is the think about your day-to-day conversations about, you know, like what we mention, like how often do you mention Iraq and Afghanistan, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan in your daily conversations? Probably not that often, right?
Probably not.
Maybe once in a while you'll mention it in specific, maybe when you're having a political argument. But we do live in a world in which that has drastically changed the way we live now, those wars. And so certainly there are verbal clues in what we're talking about, even if those things are never answered. So if we just had like a recording of Mike's daily conversation, somebody could start to piece together how he got to where he is, how the world got to the way he sees it. But maybe Mike has a different perspective on that. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah. So I know how exposition works.
Yeah, I know.
I think the film, as Paul said, missed some places, some chances to give quick exposition. I think that this is a failure throughout later parts in the film that we'll then hopefully get to move to soon. Not the failures, but the rest of the film. Someone literally tells him, we don't need more engineers, we need more farmers. That's a perfect opening for him to say, here are all these things that engineers could do. Here are all these things that I should have been able to do, that it would have been in character, it would have elucidated the world, and it would have struck home the intense realities of how effed they were on Earth. All of which builds toward what they need to do going into space. So for me, that was just a straight up failure of the writing. And I do agree that it shouldn't all be perfectly spelled out. I do think that there is cool storytelling to be done in, you know, pay attention to the visuals. I definitely agree on the Yankees. I think that's all that we have left of the Yankees.
Yeah.
And that says a lot, and that those implied wars are clear to me. But I
love
think
the
that...
moment. I'm sorry. I love the moment when he's like, you know, the Yankees used to be this big team. Who are these bums?
Mm-hmm. And the ball goes all of that was great for me. Yeah.
It's like, so that's all. It's wrong to eat popcorn at a baseball game. I want a hot dog.
Yeah. So, but I do think that what the film does is it gives us a very clear sense of how effed humanity is on Earth, so that then we have to go to space.
Mm.
And we go to space in the topic, possibly.
Okay. Well, we may have to go to space. I would just say that almost everything is answered by the phrase that we used to look up to the sky and wonder about our place in the stars. Now we just look down at the ground and think about worry about our place in the dirt. That's pretty much the line that just defines everything. That's what Coop is now living in. He's living in a world where he has been made irrelevant. And it doesn't matter how much he can sit there and argue with these people that he's an engineer and all this stuff and that he can solve the problems. We can go into space and we can fix things and yada, yada. It doesn't matter. He's a man who's been beaten down. He's had everything stripped from him. He lives in a world where that stuff is literally considered bullshit and a waste of money based on what's in that textbook. That one line in the textbook basically defines Coop's life. He is now considered an irrelevant person. Rachel.
Well, actually, it's not that he's considered even irrelevant. It's that they've basically decided that the moon, you know, space exploration was a lie. So it's not that Coop is irrelevant. It's that he's actually like a liar. like a codified liar, according to that society. So I the only thing I wanted to say is, you know, honestly, this world building stuff did not bother me at all. The only thing is I actually felt for they're with the amount of time that they spent on Earth, there probably should have been more. I think if the front end of the movie had been a bit shorter, it would have been better to, you know, with the amount of information they gave it went on. It was a bit to the long side.
Yeah, I'm okay with that.
I keep wondering, when are we going to get to space? When are we going to get to space? When are we going to get to space? Sean, can we go to space now?
Yeah. Let's go to space.
All right, let's talk about space. So who's got a thing they'd like to talk about with space?
Okay, I would like to start.
Go for it, Paul.
I loved, and this goes back to the practical effects. I mean, I'm gonna compare this movie to Prometheus, which is slick over technological. It feels like which is in comparison to Alien, which is really weird. This over technological future. This going into space with retro NASA technology and practical effects and feeling like you're living on a NASA spaceship going to Saturn and beyond. I like that a lot. That brought me back to 2001. That brought me back to Gravity. It felt like I could walk around that spaceship and live on it and do stuff on that spaceship. It felt real and good to me. We don't get a lot of, I mean, the wormhole itself is quote a cheat, but we'll get into that as we go into that. But it takes them a couple of years to get to Saturn, and that's right. It should take a couple of years to get to Saturn, even if you are doing a lot of acceleration. I mean, there is a little bit of technological futurism with the with those tanks to allow people to cryosleep, but I'll accept that because otherwise, 2 years on that ship would be really boring, not to mention I can imagine how things could go really wrong between Anne Hathaway and Michael McConaughey if they had 2 years together on that ship, God help them. So I really like that this feels like a real science fiction world once we get to space. We're on a spaceship, man, and we're going to the stars. I was all on board for that.
Yeah, I agreed with that they actually took time seriously throughout the film. It was really good.
We'll talk about that late in a little bit, I think.
Well, I just mean in the literal sense. They're already a little bit of hand-waving in this movie. Like, there are some things where it just kind of takes that little bit of sci-fi leap where it kind of goes that next little level. They could have just cheated and been like, and by the way, we can get to Mars in 6 days and all these kinds of garbage. But they didn't do that. I appreciated that they actually, like, the trip literally took them years to get to Saturn. And then, you know, it took them months to get to Miller's planet and all of this kind of stuff. It was not a quick journey. So, Mike, I see you had a hand.
Yeah, I had the most fun of this film during Act Two, going to space and get the cryo sleep and Miller's planet with the giant waves and TARS and Case and all of the it's in space and it's science fiction and it's a gigantic film and I'm watching it on IMAX is a dream come true. Yeah. And I, as much as I have criticisms, I wanted to really focus on how much I loved all of these space bits in Act Two, because it was glorious to see this type of exploratory science fiction on the big screen.
Agreed.
And not even cartoony science fiction, real grounded science fiction. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, going to another movie, the way we were just talking about. Consider Galaxy Quest when they find out they're in space and Tim Allen's character says, "We're in space!" It's like, that's how I felt in this movie. Like, we're in space! They're in space! They're really, really in space! Not even on a cartoon TV show ship. They're in space in a relatively realistic-looking spacecraft. Mm. It's like, hell yeah! Hell to the end! Give me more of this! Act One was too long. Now we're going to enjoy this. One hopes.
yeah, there are a couple things I also really appreciated about the stuff in space. So, I mean, visually, we've already talked about that. It's gorgeous. I don't know if we have to go into that too much, but, like, gargantuous, fucking gorgeous.
Oh, God, yes.
I want to.
Black hole ever.
Oh, my God. Black hole ever. I mean, the first time I saw, I went to an IMAX as well. And the first time I saw that, it was just, like, breathtaking. Because here's this destructive thing and it is rendered as, I mean, it's gorgeous. Like, I want that on my wall. Like, I want, like, not a picture. I want, like, a moving picture where it's got the gases moving. I want that on my wall because it's gorgeous. It's also kind of terrifying. But the other thing I like that this is a film that avoids the Star Wars problem where things make lots of sound in space. I get it, George Lucas. You love sound effects, and you can make really cool bomb sounds and laser noises. But in space, things don't make noise because there's no air. So there's like a moment towards the end, and I know this is Act 3, but whatever, in which Matt Damon's character basically blows up half of the bloody hell, what's the name of the ship? Like Intrepid or something. I don't know. Whatever. It starts with an E. It blows up half of this ship, and we don't actually hear it. We watch it from within the cargo ship, as Matthew McConaughey and Anne Hathaway are trying to reason with Matt Damon. And so all we see is the explosion. We don't hear anything. I love that. The endurance, as Paul just put in the notes. Thank you. I love the use of sound, and Hans Zimmer's soundtrack really plays a good role in this because, of course, that's what's adding the tension because there's no sound to add the tension in the scenes. So I'm sure Rachel will want to talk about Hans Zimmer. I will just say there's not enough horn sex for me.
Yeah, there's not nearly enough horns.
There's enough.
It's all like organ, which was different for Hans Zimmer, but
it's him experimenting, which I appreciate. It's not like
have you
love John Williams
yet?
No, I haven't. I've heard it though. I love John Williams. I really do love him, but his soundtracks get very samey because he's sort of just following that same dramatic model all like over and over, like the leitmotif stuff, and like that's great. But if you're not trying new things, this is why I think Hans Zimmer currently is the greatest film composer alive. Because he is always constantly pushing, trying to do different things. So, like, the story about how he started making the music for Interstellar was basically Christopher Nolan, who, duh, he's going to use Hans Zimmer because, duh. He basically, like, sent Hans Zimmer a note. It said, you've got, like, a day to come up with some music. Here's the theme of the movie. You come up with shit. And Hans Zimmer was like, I'm just going to play with an organ. That's how he came up with the theme that eventually appears in the movie. That's great.
The soundtrack's fantastic. I pre-ordered it, so yeah. I mean, I was gonna say just the one thing that made me so angry about the soundtrack. There were a couple places where I don't know if it was the sound balancing on the 35mm or what, but the soundtrack got so, like, the music got so loud I couldn't hear what the characters were saying, and it's like, it's fine if it's not something important, but the way it was, I couldn't tell if they were talking about something important. So
I had that problem.
That's intentional. That was intentional. The sound for the film, I forget the guy who said this, but basically Nolan wanted to have the sound be part of the story, in the sense that scenes in which there is a lot of noise, so like, for example, when they're in the ship and they're shooting off the rockets, right, it's a shit ton of noise. You can't really hear very well. That eventually comes out, not just in the music, but also in the sound effects. I don't think it quite works. I understand why they did it, and I think it's a cool idea. I think the problem with it is we didn't go to Interstellar to have trouble hearing the dialogue. And you end up with a problem where some of the dialogue becomes very obscured. And it's sort of like one of those moments where if you've watched it in theater the first time, you're like, well, what did they just say? Was it important? Do I need to know that information? I think in most cases it probably wasn't important information, but it's still kind of one of those issues where the sound could be overbearing. But I think, Mike, you had a hand a while back, so I'm going to let you talk.
It's along the same lines. I think that the sound mixing was a mistake. From a narrative standpoint, being like, I still, you know, I love music and I love soundtracks and all, but even like, I knew going in that Nolan had said, oh, I want the soundtrack to dominate. And I thought it was a bad choice. I thought it was an amazing soundtrack, but I thought it was a bad choice. I don't think the film itself told me that I didn't need to hear that dialogue.
I think that's fair.
Yeah. Just to jump in just a bit, just to jump in real quick. I was thinking, he was mentioning, I'm thinking of the movie Solaris, where the soundtrack is also very important and powerful. But when the soundtrack is dominating, the characters are muted. You can see them talking, but you don't hear what they say. And that's a narrative and film twist is showing, okay, what they're saying isn't important. What you're feeling from hearing the music as they're doing their body language is more important. And this movie doesn't do that. This movie just drowns out the dialogue rather than just making it clear that the soundtrack is what you should be hearing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this is something that Nolan and Hans Zimmer have done before. I mean, they did something, I mean, in terms of trying to incorporate the soundtrack into the narrative itself. I mean, in Inception, they did the same thing. The music becomes a central part of how we tell where we are in the world. If you listen, for example, in Inception, when they go to deeper levels of the dream, the music changes intentionally. It actually slows down on purpose. Obviously, also that French song also will play over, and you hear that as well. And with the way the songs are structured, the soundtrack for Inception is actually incredibly simplistic in terms of the depth of the kinds of music. It's not like, you know, flourishes and fanfares. But in Inception, it's intentional because the music is constantly layering on new things in the same way that you're adding new layers to the dream world. In this, it seems like it's somewhat lazy. It's sort of like we want the sound, the music to be overbearing because that's what it's going to be like in this, like when you're firing off rockets and things, it'll just be so much noise that you can't really hear anyway. I feel like I agree that that's a mistake. I think it becomes overbearing, and I think what ends up happening is it does become somewhat of a distraction, and that's a problem because then it's drawing attention away from those moments. I think if there wasn't dialogue during those moments, it would be better, but I also think that having the soundtrack so overbearing in even in those tense moments, I think that isn't effective at doing what it does. I think it becomes, as we're talking about, it became very clearly for almost all of us, I think all of us, those moments just became distracting. Mm-hmm. Rather than maybe tense as we should have had it. I think it would have been much more interesting if in those moments there was no sound except for the sound of the rockets. That would have been much more interesting to me if the soundtrack goes away. And I know you can't do that with Hans Zimmer because he wants to have horn sex and now it's organ sex, but you know.
That sounds really dirty.
It does. Yeah, he
organ
loves his
sex.
Well, now he's giving me organ sex. He usually does horn sex in my ear, and now it's organ sex. So, yeah. But in any case, So, do we want to skip to another topic on space?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to go, Paul, or does someone else want to drop one in?
I'll go.
All right, go for it, Paul.
Okay, so I am of two minds about the planets in this film.
Okay.
Okay, and it's mainly most of my problems come from the water planet, but I appreciated the visuals we got. I mean, the planets do seem a little bit of one ecosystem, one biome sort of lazy Star Trek sort of look. Like all the planets seems to be just this or this or this, which kind of annoys me because even Mars is, which is a dry, dusty world, has diversity in it. But it was nice to see. It was nice to see the Iceland Tourism Board has gotten a lot more revenue out of this film. It seems like every other movie I see that's set in weird places has Iceland as the backdrop, which was interesting. But the water planet kind of annoyed me, and the reason why it annoyed me was that I think the movie kind of cheats the science a little bit. To have a planet to have that sort of severe time dilation, now we've gotten a real small topic, that I don't think you can get that on the outside of the event horizon of the black hole. And even if you did, I think there would be other clues before they even go near that they shouldn't do this, they shouldn't go anywhere near that planet. And it felt like, as I was leaving the theater and talking with a friend over lunch, that it felt like it was a narrative device. That planet is just a narrative device to age the characters and so that we can have time pass on Earth and nothing else. And that really kind of, and also to kill off characters so that we basically drop down the characters in space to Coop and Brand.
All right, Rachel, are you going to drop some truth pillows on Paul?
Oh, God.
Well, I was just going to say, Paul, did you read the series of tweets that Neil deGrasse Tyson did about Interstellar?
I don't think so. summarize them.
I'm trying to remember. I'm looking at the tweets now, but I'm pretty sure he even mentioned like the waves.
Yeah.
Though I do like what he does. He said they explore a planet near a black hole. Personally, I'd stay as far the hell away from black holes as I can, which I would tend to agree with. But you know,
desperation.
This is a really weird solar system that they have planets in orbit around the black hole because it's clearly one solar system. And there must be a black hole, and which is an orbit around another star. We don't see the star, but there must be one. So it's a really weird solar system, this wormhole.
I was very confused by the setup of the solar system, but here, this is the tweet I was looking for. It says, "In Interstellar, you observe great tidal waves from great tidal forces of magnitude that orbiting a black hole might create." So Neil deGrasse Tyson said the giant waves were okay.
Okay, so here come the truth pillows, Paul.
Uh-oh. You
ready for the truth pillows?
We're cross-referencing with our friends over at Doorway to Thin World, I see.
Yes, yes. So there are a couple posts at Slate from, I believe he's a physicist, that have talked about whether or not the planet that orbits so close, Miller's planet, whether or not it is in fact theoretically possible. And it is in fact theoretically possible for you to have, around certain types of black holes, a planet orbiting so close that it would actually have dilation as a result. Obviously, as Rachel was pointing out, that the tidal waves, whether or not they look exactly as they look in the film, who knows, but they certainly would exist because of the tidal forces.
I'm not upset about the tidal waves themselves. I'm just upset about them even thinking to go there. I mean, it's clearly a shallow world because they're walking in this ocean. So shallowness equals tidal waves. I'm fine with that. It's just like, why the hell are you going anywhere near this planet?
Because they were told that it's safe. Remember that they send off 12 people. For those that are still listening and don't mind having things spoiled, earlier in the film, before they even leave Earth, Dr. Brand / Michael Caine reminds us that basically, they sent out 12 people on a suicide mission to the 12 worlds that became visible through the wormhole. Their mission was basically, you go out there, you set up shop. If your planet's habitable, you click the button, we get the message, and then we come, right? And that we bring a potential civilizing mission there, done and done. But everyone else, the other 11, basically die. So 11 people are going to die, one person gets to live. And so basically what they end up in this solar system, they found three worlds that seem like they're habitable based on information we've received. And so they're basically doing a cost-benefit analysis. Do we go to this planet that has been sending us a message that it says it's good, even though it's close to the black hole? And that's basically what we're presented with, is this message has been coming from this planet, Miller's planet, saying it, it's good to go. It's got organics, it's got water, it's got all the stuff we need for life. The problem is, and I think that from a narrative perspective is an issue, is why didn't they realize that the message that was being sent was being affected by the dilation to the point where when they land, they realize that she'd only just recently landed. I didn't quite understand why that was there. That seemed convenient to kill off Doyle.
Age the movie. That's the only reason why this planet exists, basically, right? to kill him off and to age Earth. And that really felt bad world building.
If, for example, they had said, you know, she's been there, like maybe she's been there a year in her time, if they didn't make the dilation like so severe, because the dilation in the movie says an hour on the planet is 7 years our time. Yeah. If they made the dilation a little less severe and then had some sort of weird communication trickery that they didn't realize until the last second, not realizing that the planet was hostile for some other reason, she pushed the button and then she got killed, and they don't realize that until they get there. Huh?
That's what they implied, but she died
like within minutes.
She got hit by a tidal wave right after she was like, this place is awesome! Hit the button, tidal wave.
Right. If they had made it a little bit where she's there for, you know, a little bit longer, right, she thinks it's good and then she dies, but that beacon's been sending the same message for at least a significant portion of time, so that there's no reason for them to go, oh, well, that planet must be fucked up. Let's not go there, right? Like, it didn't make quite enough sense to me why they wouldn't, like, why they still went, knowing that this planet most likely is pretty dangerous, and knowing that she's only been there for a little while. It seems to me that from a cost-benefit analysis, it's so close to the black hole, why don't we go to the other planet that says good news, which is Dr. Man Planet / Matt Damon, who is in this movie and I wanted to make out with the whole time.
Oh my God. You said Dr. Man Planet.
Dr. Man Planet. Dr. Man's Planet. It's Dr. Man.
Planet Man.
Right, it's Planet Man. It's Man's Planet. M-A-N-N, not Man. But it seemed like, for me, that was one of the things I didn't like, and I think I didn't like that scene in particular because Doyle, his death didn't make sense to me.
Doyle got fridged, which is kind of hilarious.
Yeah, because what
even was his job?
Well, he's oh God.
His job was to get killed by the tidal wave.
He's a physicist.
But they didn't do the 2 second thing of Brand is our planetologist, this guy is our our quantum theorist, and this is our physicist.
Every other
solid space SF film takes that 2 seconds, and this one didn't, which was strange.
Yeah, I mean, there may be a line and we just forgot.
Yeah, it had plenty of time to do this.
Yeah. So basically Doyle, so there's the scene, they land, they realize the waves are coming, but they want to get the data. Anne Hathaway goes to get the data out of the thing, but of course the gravity's 130% Earth, so they get really tired, and so Tars has to go save her, and he's running and like doing quick things, and I'm like, what is Doyle doing just standing there? Run. I didn't understand, like,
Tars to the rescue. Yes,
they should have killed him better. They should have had it to where, like, maybe Doyle was the one that went for the data, and Anne Hathaway's like, get the fuck in the thing, hurry up, what are you doing? And she gets in, and Doyle can't get back in time, and he dies. Or something to where his death makes more sense. It seemed like his death was like he just didn't want to run. Which didn't make sense to me, because he should have got there before Tars got there anyway. Or Case, whoever it was. It was Case, sorry. Because they left Tars because he's got a mouth. They intentionally left him.
Because he's the sassy robot.
Because he's got too much sass. Go ahead.
I did just want to say one thing about, like, Case going and rescuing Anne Hathaway. That was finally, like, because when you're first seeing these robots where they kind of have that look like the monolith, which was intentional, and you're just like, the fuck built a robot that looks like this, and it just is sort of going to waddle around. And then it suddenly is like, now I'm going to turn into like the rolling wheel of awesome. And you're like, oh. So that's why they built those robots like that. Yep. Okay.
They're super cool.
I mean, yeah, I hated that planet, but yeah, when he turns into that pinwheel, it's a pinwheel. I was like, okay, that's cool.
He's got all the little arms that can come out and stuff. It's really cool.
Well, it's like just this modular thing. So I think that the robots can probably just reform themselves into nearly anything they need to be that would work, which is like, that's a cool idea.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I mean, the robots were really cool. I didn't like that scene. I just didn't.
Yeah.
Doyle's death for me. I kept thinking, like, why aren't you running? Like, you're, like, 5 feet from the fucking door. Get inside. I didn't understand that. I understand why they wanted to kill him, because they wanted to put more stakes, realizing that this mission is about humanity, but is also extremely dangerous for them, to remind us how dangerous this is. But I think that they should have done that better. They should have had his death be a little bit more meaningful.
Yeah.
The other interesting thing that occurred to me later is that this planet has a severe time dilation. Now, even if it was perfectly habitable, what you're going to get is something. Any of you read the novel Spin by Robert Charles Wilson?
Go ahead.
No. Anyway, I'm going to spoil part of Spin, but the whole trilogy is that anyway. Anyway, at one point after the Earth's been bubbled by the aliens in this time field, we managed to get a shot off to Mars, and Mars isn't in that time field for a while, so a whole Martian civilization rises and falls and goes to great heights in a relatively short time on Earth because of this field that's around the Earth. So I was thinking of that. It's like you would have a weird situation where you'd have civilizations rising and falling on Earth while this goes slowly. Also, see Charles Carl Schrader's lockstep for that sort of idea as well, is about having civilizations out of sync in time. If we had actually got a civilization on this planet, it would be terribly out of sync with the rest of humanity in short order, which might not be such a great idea, but it's something I was thinking about as I left the movie. But the tidal waves kind of wipe out anything anyway. But even without the tidal waves, it'd be a really weird place to put a colony. And I think the podcast goes silent again. God help me.
Shall we go to Man Planet?
Let's go to Man Planet.
Sorry, my mic was muted while I was trying to talk because I'm a dumbass. Oh. No, I was saying that I understand why they go there out of desperation. If you have no other viable options, then you go there. At the same time, it is one of those moments in the film that just doesn't quite work, because there's a piece of information missing to make that work. So it was also the closest one, as Rachel was noting in the comments.
Yeah, because I remember Cooper was like having a shit fit over, like, suddenly he needed to get home to his kids because he's going to win the Dad of the Year award.
Yeah, but he also makes a really brilliant argument, which is, you know, we're going to spend all of this time going to all of these places. We're going to spend years and years and years doing this. It's made very clear to him that the urgency with which they need to find a habitable world and send a message back is severe. Mankind is like on its last legs. It's gonna poop out really quick. So for him, he's like, I'm not just thinking about my family. I'm thinking about every other family on that earth, because if we find a habitable world and there's nobody left to save, plan A fails. And everyone's like, well, that's why we have plan B. And he's like, fuck your plan B, because I've got a daughter.
And so, if we don't, in just 1 year, Mother Earth will disappear. I'm sure Mike got that reference. Maybe Rachel did too.
I don't know what you're saying.
No, actually.
Battle Beyond the Stars?
Oh my god, that's on Torture Cinema.
It's been way too long.
Oh god. Anyway, let's go to Man Planet, as Mike said, because clearly I'm just confusing everyone today.
I'm never going to get over this.
Man Planet. The Man Planet.
Anne Hathaway cannot go there. It is the Man Planet.
Very convenient that a man was on the planet. A man by the name of Matt Damon.
Right, so I had a question about Man Planet, and this is just kind of world building. Did you all think that it was only ever those kind of arcing spires all the way down, that there, like, that's what he meant by there is no surface?
I actually saw. Did you guys read the little comic?
Mm-mm.
Oh, there's no.
I'm gonna have to find the link and maybe put it in the show notes as well. There's a comic which explains Dr. Mann's visit to the planet, and basically there is, as much as he lies about it, there is no surface to this planet, and he knows it. It is just ice, condensed ice all the way down. There is no solid surface to this planet, which kind of violates some laws of planetology and geology, as I'm sure Rachel could say in more detail, but yeah. Mm-hmm. Because it's not large enough to be a gas giant. Even a gas giant's got something solid at the center. So, but yeah, there is no solid surface to this planet whatsoever. And that tie-in comic makes that absolutely clear, and he knows it, so he's lying through his ass.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Rachel?
I mean, I don't really have anything to say from a planetology argument other than, I was like, what the fuck do you mean that there's not a surface? Does not compute. How is it? There should be at least like the rocky center, like the Tootsie Roll in the center of the Tootsie Pop.
Yeah.
I was very confused by that. I just assumed that what he meant was that it's like covered with an extremely dense layer of this ice that you can't get through. Yeah. But you can't trust anything he says because he's a fucking liar.
It's a very short comic. I just linked it in the chat, and we'll probably link it in the show notes too.
Cool. Thanks a lot. Yeah, I'll keep it in mind for the show notes. So, so what did you make of the Matt Damon becoming the betrayer narrative? I'm curious what everybody thought about that, because it does seem like every planet gets its sort of mini narrative. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious. Mike, you have a thought on this?
Yeah, I saw it coming not as early as my fiance did, but I saw it coming basically as soon as they got into the scene of the two of them walking, because of the soundtrack.
Mm.
The soundtrack told me betrayal. So that was, I don't know if it was meant to be a tip of the hat, to set you up to kind of fear for Cooper in the way that I did in that scene. I think that Mann's characterization fits as a kind of a monstrous person. The trick there is that it's really depressing to have this character who was set up to be the best of us. You know, he was our guiding light, and for the film to assert that someone that, you know, like that much of guiding light was so weak that they would go to such lengths to survive.
Yeah, it's pretty intense. Rachel?
I mean, what I found interesting is, yeah, it's like, man, like, it was his idea, it was supposed to be the best of us, but it was like, that part was where all of the betrayal comes out. And I was actually very surprised, like, how, you know, how significantly that theme of betrayal was in this movie, because that, you know, you've got kind of like at the beginning, you've got this feeling of personal betrayal where Murph is like, dad left me, but then you find out all of this shit with Michael Caine's character where he's like, oh yeah, there's actually not an answer. I've been lying to everyone forever. I'm just, you know, I'm just trying to keep everyone from giving up hope. Like, to me, that was actually an even more major betrayal than what Mann did. And then it all comes out at once where you find out Mann's like, oh yeah, totally, you know, there was never going to actually be an option for getting everyone off the planet. It was always the frozen embryos, and Coop's like, what the fuck? And then Mann's like, and now I'm going to betray you and try to kill you in like 20 minutes. So it all comes out at once. And so that was actually what I found interesting about Mann was, and in retrospect, like, I was actually kind of surprised when he physically tried to kill Cooper, even though at that point I shouldn't have been, because the soundtrack was warning us. But there was even that bigger hint of him being like, oh yeah, you know, the plan was always the frozen embryos, so we should do a thing with that. And so it's like he's already kind of betrayed everyone once in that sense that, you know, with Michael Caine, and then he's taking it one step further and being like, now I'm going to steal all the embryos and go to a planet that doesn't suck.
Hmm. Yeah, so just to add to that, because we haven't really talked about it, like, we went to the space thing, but we forgot to mention that there is a secondary narrative which is taking place involving Cooper's kids, right? This is after they get back from Miller's planet, and we get this sub-narrative of his grown-up children trying to survive on this Earth, and of course Murph has started to work with Dr. Brand to try to solve the problem, because Murph turns out to be a genius, which is nice. And so when Rachel's talking about, like, that betrayal, it is, like, the ultimate betrayal. This is the narrative's low point. Like, mm-hmm. This is the ultimate low. They find out that they all were lied to. The daughter finds out that it was a lie. She doesn't know whether or not her father knew it was a lie. You know, whether or not that her father left her there to die, which would be, like, the single most ultimate betrayal, was, like, not only did you leave me, you left here knowing I was going to die. I mean, that's a horrible feeling. And then, of course, Jessica Chastain having to give that performance.
Oh, my God.
God, that was good.
I was, like, crying. I was like, ugh, why?
Because that's a horrible, like, can you imagine feeling that, like, your own parent leaves you behind to die? I mean, that's a horrible prospect, right? I mean, that's a really horrible thing. Yeah, I mean, it is, I think, for me, the one of the best parts of this, because this is also when we get a lot of finally the narrative gets some physical tension, not least of all because Dr. Mann on Mann's planet, for you, Rachel, for
I'm
you.
Sorry.
You know, he tries to kill Coop, and then, of course, he tries to steal the Endurance and ends up blowing half the fucking thing up and resulting in this beautiful shot of them trying to dock with this out of control Endurance, the spinning out of control Endurance that's going to burn up in the atmosphere. Like, that scene is amazing. I love that scene. So Paul, go.
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to mention that real quick. Have any of you ever played the old video game Elite?
Nope.
Mm-mm. Wow. I have the shooting blanks here today. Anyway, Elite wasn't actually just tried to reboot it. Elite was an old little video game from the 1990s, very primitive vector graphics, where you basically piloted the spaceship between star systems, tried to make money, got into fights, tried to survive in a hostile universe. The hardest thing in Elite is docking with space stations. It is so difficult to do it because you get because it's so fiddly. There is no autopilot, and I mean, I crashed so many bloody spaceships, started crashing space stations in that game. It's not even funny. And as they're trying to think that, I'm thinking this is the ultimate game of elite here. As we have Cooper trying to dock with the space station, and it's spinning, and he's spinning, and I love the physics of that because he realizes in order to latch up with it, he's got to get his ship spinning too. It's like so much beautiful. And afterwards, I was getting my friends. This reminds me of Elite so much. It's like the worst space station in Elite trying to dock with this thing. But he managed it. And it also shows how hard this is. I mean, I appreciated the Matt Damon blowing up the Endurance. Half the Endurance was showing how difficult it is to actually get it right. It gives us – I mean, we had been told Coop is a great pilot. And here we actually get the full-on goods on, yes, he's a really good pilot. Because we hadn't really gotten that to this point. I mean the landing on the water planet, okay, but here's where Coop actually makes his bones in the movie by showing how not only doing a difficult thing, but doing it in the almost extreme situation. He rolled the 20 and had all his bonuses and spent all his fate points to make that happen, and it was glorious.
Yep.
But anyway.
How many G's do you think they're pulling when they're doing that spin?
Oh, God.
Because Anne Hathaway passes out.
Yeah. They got to be 3 to 4 at least. Yeah, but the whole Dr. Man being the betrayer thing on Man Planet, it kind of reminded me almost like Reverse 2001, where it's the AI that betrays humans. Here, it's a man that we bring it to ourselves, and it's man that betrays man. I thought that was a neat symbolic sort of reversal from 2001.
And kills his AI.
Oh. And kills his AI. Yes, exactly. So yeah, Nolan was clearly thinking 2001 and seeing how he could subvert and reverse and twist all sorts of tropes that way.
Yeah, absolutely. This is something that some people have already talked about, that, you know, in 2001, it's the robot that does the bad thing, the AI that kills. In this case, it's man. It's the worst of man that actually, the worst part of humanity that does the damage. And it's man betraying his own creations. And I love that switch, because it makes the robots not the terrifying ones. It makes humanity the terrifying ones. Which is accurate.
Yeah.
So I thought it was beautiful. So we are almost at an hour and a half, or like an hour and 15 minutes,
oh,
or something.
Oh my god, now. Yeah.
Yeah.
Should well, there's so much to talk about.
There has been, which is a good thing. Should we maybe talk about the ending? The you know, after they've saved the spaceship, the Endurance, and now they're going to go to Edmund's planet with what little they have left. And Coop decides to sacrifice himself to a certain degree by dropping his ass and TARS into a black hole in order to see if they can get any data that will help the people at home. So
yes,
we should talk about this because, of course, Coop ends up falling into a tesseract.
Into a higher dimensional space.
A tesseract.
Yeah.
I think tesseract is technically 4 dimensions in 3, but I'm not a mathematician, but it's a 3-dimensional representation of a 5-dimensional space with time as a physical dimension.
Right. Yeah, they call it the tesseract. So I think that's just to give it a name, because I don't know what else you would call it. The synchoract, I guess. Right.
The Hilbert space. I don't know.
Something. Well, Rachel, why don't you jump, because you got first. You got first dibs.
Yeah. I mean, I have very, very mixed feelings about that part of the movie. Like, you know, I of course, it's like the timey-wimey bullshit. Fine.
No. Yeah. There is no timey-wimey bullshit, and I'm going to explain why when you and Paul are done, and I'm going to blow some fucking minds.
Okay, no. So this is my problem with the timey-wimey bullshit. If the others had been anything but highly evolved humans, I could have bought it.
Yep.
But as soon as they defined the others, which I would have actually, like, when I came out of the movie, I was like, you know, I actually kind of like it. And now that I've thought about it more, and I'm like, it would have been better for the movie to not have, to have left the others as just some kind of like, we don't know why they did this. They're an unknowable entity because they are so much more highly evolved. That I would have been better with than being the highly evolved humanity, because frankly, then it gets into the you being your own grandpa problem.
Mm-hmm.
And because the paradox then And this started to bother me, like, as soon as I got in the shower after I took the movie and I was, like, washing my hair, and I'm like, motherfucker, why? Like, so, in order for humanity to become this highly evolved species, they needed to get off the planet and go do the stuff and, you know, evolve for millions of years, but then the only way they could get off the planet was if they had gotten off the planet so they could send the portal back, and then my brain melted, and I was like, why did you do this to me, Chris Nolan? I thought we were friends.
Bootstrap paradox, yep.
You all keep going. Go ahead, Mike. You get it out. I'm taking notes. I'm going to refute everything you say and show out why I clearly understood this movie and none of you did.
How did we get off of Earth the first time if we've never already become the five-dimensional species?
Yes. Thank you for summarizing my shampooing problem.
All right, Paul, what do you think?
Mike is absolutely right. This is a bootstrap paradox of the first order. How did we get off the planet in the first place? I mean, without the intervention of the five-dimensional aliens, it's a full-on bootstrap information paradox, not only for the creation of the aliens, but also getting the information to Cooper on how he gets to NASA. I mean, it just goes round and round again, and I would have preferred it be unknowable 2001 style aliens rather than saying it's us. I can see why, from a thematic point, why they say it's us, because if you consider we see no other aliens, no extraterrestrial creatures, all we see in space is ourselves and what we brought, which is the robots. So he's trying to narrow that and not open up that box to things beyond man, but in so doing, he's created this bootstrap paradox, which I'm fine with a bootstrap paradox because, well, I read by his bootstraps when I was 10, so I'm fine with that. I think they could have done it in a better way, and or at least acknowledged that this is what they had created, basically this ontological problem.
All right, y'all ready for some truth pillows?
Go for it.
All right. Well, I'll agree on one thing. I think that the way they did it was a little kind of hokey. I didn't quite like it. I didn't hate it. I kind of just felt like I understand why they went with the route they went, and I can see it, and I understand the visual representation and all of that stuff. I can understand it's explained in the film why they go with this visual tesseract kind of thing as a way to communicate and all these kinds of things. That makes sense. I just think I don't know. It just kind of was a little weird. However, I'm going to break all of your minds right this second, because all of you are accepting what Coop says as fact. But Coop is in no position to actually make a determination on anything. This is what Coop thinks they are. But Coop, he never tells us, they told me they're humanity. Humanity, the alien others, never tell us that they are humanity evolved. At no point do we have any – in fact, even the robot questions him. Tars even tells him, like, how do you know they're humans? That seems kind of weird. How do you know they want to communicate? And all Coop is going is like, because I know. He's basically taking a giant faith leap in order to make sense of something he doesn't even understand, and something which we don't really understand either, because a five-dimensional being wouldn't make sense to us, because their grasp of the dimensions would be so different as to make them – super alien. So this is Coop's attempts to understand what is going on, and there's no way to relay that without undermining Coop's epiphany. So from Coop's perspective, he believes that they are man, that they are people, right? Even though he has no reason to believe, in the same way that his daughter believes that it's his father, that it's her father that is sending the messages back, even though she has no reason, at least until he reveals it later, that that's actually what happens. So that's the first part. Mike, I'm sure, wants to disagree with me, and then I'll
keep going.
Truth pillows. No. You can go that part. I'll explain the rest later.
So why couldn't the other beings have been the ghosts the first time? The fact that it has to have been Coop means that they have to have pulled him out of a timeline that he wouldn't have existed in order to have him be the ghost, to put him on the timeline that he needs to have been in to become the ghost.
And this is where the other truth pillow comes in. I like truth pillows, by the way. They're really, really comfy. So here's the problem, because you all think that there's a bootstrap paradox involved here, but there actually isn't. And that's explained very easily by the fact that these are five-dimensional beings, which means they are not bound by linear time. Paradoxes only exist within a linear time frame. So in Back to the Future, you can get a time paradox because they're going back in time and eventually into the future on their own timeline. They're not actually escaping that timeline. But in any case, so the beings who live in five dimensions, one of those dimensions includes time, which means they are not bound to linear time, which means they can go across any amount of time, which also means that they are not bound to any particular version of the universe. They can change it at will and access any possible version, which essentially brings in this whole multiverse theoretical construct, which is, I think, is fairly part of what they intended here. At least I think so. I haven't read the Interstellar Science book, but given that there's been a lot of talk about multiverse as a theoretical construct in theoretical physics, I think that's exactly what's going on here. And so these beings, for reasons we don't understand, Coop tries to make sense of it, although he never comes up with an answer in the end when Tars is like, well, why would they do anything? It is like, he's like, fuck knows. Like, why wouldn't, like, I don't know, love, man? Like, that's the answer, right? Love is why they did it. But that's Coop's attempts to rationalize something he doesn't understand. I mean, after all, these are beings who live in a time they had to create a bizarre, confusing, four-dimensional space to shove Coop into in order for him to make sense of anything, because trying to communicate with beings that don't even exist in the same number of dimensions as you do is kind of impossible because they don't understand anything. I mean, imagine if you had access to every moment in time, real or imagined. I mean, would we make sense to you? I mean, we're stuck in linear time. Right, like Flatland. That was one video that was shared about that. But Mike has a hand. I think I've gotten the truth pillars out. So go for it, Mike.
I accept that these can be five-dimensional beings who can jump across quantum realities. And in fact, I prefer a version where they are from a different quantum a quantum shard or whatever you want to call it. But they utilize human actors who are bound by three-dimensional causality. If they had just – if the five-dimensional beings had been the ones to create the ghosts and to – basically, all they needed – they needed to create the ghosts to put them on the path to get to NASA. Coop can then do everything else because he will have already gotten to be on a timeline that would put him in a position that then the five-dimensional beings could send him back within an –
You just became a robot, Mike.
So that's where it breaks for me.
You need to repeat that last line.
Okay, so if the five-dimensional beings had been the ghosts that had put Coop and Murph on the path to find NASA, then I would have no problems because it wouldn't actually be a bootstrap paradox because there would already have been created a timeline where he would get to space. And at that point, then you can create a five-dimensional to three-dimensional tesseract in order to let him pass along the gravity well data so that they can escape Earth. That would work, but as is, it doesn't work for me.
And more truth pillows, because this needs to be dropped down. Again, this is something that Paul and I had a conversation with about already. Coop is actually removed from his timeline and put into a timeline that exists outside of it. Or rather, it's not a timeline at all. He's being given access to five dimensions through essentially what is a funnel. So, in fact, doesn't violate his timeline because he's being removed from it. He is given access to the same information they are given. He just doesn't understand it. So, no, it's not actually a bootstrap paradox. He's creating a new timeline. He's removed. He's removed from his timeline. He is no longer bound by the dimensions of time. He has access to all periods and all moments of time, all of them.
Along that time frame. But the problem is, where did this all begin? I mean, if we continue with these are evolved humans problem, then they basically have used Coop to engineer their own creation, which doesn't work. I mean. And even so, it's like Cooper gets information from himself. Even if he's pulled out of the timeline, he's still getting information from himself in the future, which just goes round and round, on and on forever.
No, fundamentally impossible for it to go round and round because he's not within his own timeline when he's presenting the information. Bootstrap paradox only works if you're transmitting information across your own timeline while still within the timeline.
Mike.
He has to have gotten to space the first time. And to have gotten to space the first time, he had to have already sent himself a message. If the five-dimensional beings had been the one to be the ghosts and to send the message and the coordinates to get to NASA, I would have zero problems. But
yeah,
he cannot have already gotten along his own timeline farther that in order to give himself the information to get to that part of the timeline. That part cannot work even with the intervention of five-dimensional beings for it to have had to have been him.
Oh, that's fun.
Mike is absolutely right, and I notice Rachel is being absolutely quiet about this. I mean, where's the original timeline where they get to space?
There isn't one.
There has to be one, otherwise you get a bootstrap paradox.
Nope, there does not have to be one, because beings who are not bound by time have no origin, no endpoint. There is zero timeline for these beings. They have access to all time. They can change time at any point they want to. They are not bound by it. You're talking about it in linear terms.
Okay, if they are extra-dimensional non-human beings, then we have no problem. But by introducing them and saying their humanity evolved, then you get the problem. So if they're 2001-esque aliens, then I think Mike and I can agree that we have much less problems with the paradox in this movie, and we can go forward, especially if they're the ones that provide the information. But by using a human actor in a timeline, they set up a whole sort of cascading set of paradoxes. I mean, and they didn't even have to. They could have been perfectly happy just being the ghosts and having Coop send the data so they can get the gravity well, and then they could send Coop into the future. That would have been all fine and dandy. I mean, the library of the Tesseract looks cute and good, and it kind of reminds me of a Zelazny story, the Three Dives of Jeremy Archer, in some ways. I don't know if any of you read that. I'm going to guess there's going to be silence.
No, silence. I haven't read it. Yeah.
Anyway, so it kind of reminded me of that, too, in some ways, because he goes into the black hole and actually winds up becoming a book in a library, which is kind of amusing. But yeah, the aliens are using human actors in a timeline, and so they're creating the paradox. If they had been the sole actors themselves, there's no paradox.
There can't be a paradox when they remove a human being from their timeline. He is no longer bound to his timeline. That's the point. For like a temporary moment, just to use horrible linear time again, he's removed from it, which means he has access to all of the time in the same way they do. Well, maybe not the same way, but in a way that at least makes sense to his brain. So, in fact, he's not actually influencing. Time paradoxes only work when you're influencing on your own timeline. If, for example, in Terminator, you have a time paradox because it's John Connor sending back Reese to have sex with his mom to give birth to John Connor. That's a time paradox because he's influencing his own timeline by sending somebody who can't have existed yet, or rather having someone who can't have existed yet send somebody back to be his own father. That's a time paradox. He's influencing his own timeline. Coop is not influencing his own timeline because he's not bound by that timeline when he's in the Tesseract. He's removed from his timeline.
But he has to have already been told by himself before he told himself.
No, he doesn't. That assumes linear time.
But he exists in linear time.
Not anymore. When he's put in the Tesseract, he no longer
does. He existed in linear time when he got the first message. So yes. I don't think we're going to be able to reconcile this.
Okay.
Sean, I'm willing to accept that I can't convince you.
Yeah, I think we have to agree to disagree here. I would like
you
to jump
agree
to the
to be wrong.
That's I would like cool. to jump to the end of the movie, though, and my problems with the end of the movie.
Actually, could I say, before we get into the end, could I just say something that did kind of, like, annoy me?
Okay, sure. Go for it.
It was not necessary. I mean, like, because, Mike, you've mentioned that whole idea of, like, love is the fifth dimension several times, and I am a big proponent of love. Love is amazing, and I really hate that shit so much. Like, oh my god, when I loved the Anne Hathaway character, because I was like, yes, a female scientist, but then when she started going on about, like, well, the you know, my love for Edmund, and you know, maybe that's just as valid as science, and I was like, why?
Rachel.
I love it. I love all of that.
Yeah, I'm so angry that speech by Brand completely undermines her as a character.
It does! It undermines her completely as a scientist, and that made me so angry!
it done so well having him having a female character in a major role as a scientist throughout the movie. Yeah, and then it kind of shoots the poo right there. Like, God help me.
Yeah, well, and then when Romilly literally said there's some things that aren't meant to be known, and he's talking about a fucking black hole and not, like, evil genetic experiments on humans, I almost came out of my seat where I was like, this is where you can tell the script was not written by a scientist.
Yeah.
and the thing is, I guess what bothers me the most about, like, because, you know, obviously scientists and scientist characters are human. So and love and emotion is a big part of humanity, but we also have to always be very conscious of the fact that, say, emotion and intuition do not have a place in the scientific process unless later you can prove them with data. And so it's like, it would have been one thing if Anne Hathaway's character had been like, as a scientist, I know this is bullshit, but this is super important to me, and I think this and this. That would have been, you know, a much better, like, a way that would not have completely undermined her character, because, you know, there are even times in my own life where I go, like, as a scientist, I know this is bullshit, but as a human being, this is how I feel.
Right, Mike? Especially because the narrative eventually asserts that she's right.
Yeah, that was the worst part! Ooh. Go ahead, sorry.
It's all good. So do we want to talk about the very ending? Paul had an issue with that?
Now that I got that out of my system, yes.
It's okay, Rachel.
Okay, because we're running along the podcast, we'll run to the ending. Okay, so at the end of the movie, so he gets shot into the future, and that lovely space change is surrounding Saturn. He finally meets his daughter again. And then what? What does the daughter say? No, I have my family here. I'm going to die with my family. You go off and find Bran. She's waiting for you. And I wanted to rage. It's like, what the fucking hell do you mean? For the entire movie, Bran has made absolutely clear that she is not interested in Cooper whatsoever. She wants the guy that went to Bran's planet. That's the person she's interested in. She's not going to go there and find him dead and wait for Cooper. We've had no indication, characterization or otherwise, and it's crappy damseling storytelling to say that Bran's going to be waiting for Cooper on that planet. Like, no.
Sorry. Yeah, the phrasing of that really bothered me, because, yeah, it did, like, this entire movie, one of the other things that made this movie cool was, you know, it's a movie about love, but the love story, such as it is, and I mean love story in the non-creepy way, is between Cooper and his daughter. And then suddenly at the end, Brand just, like, comes in out of left field. And it would be one thing, you know, and it's, again, this is where, like, the thing with script writing just – the way the lines are written is so important, where if someone had just been like, hey, you should go to Brand, she needs help, she's alone on a fucking foreign planet and is about to have a bunch of, like, babies she has to raise. Like, that would be one thing, but instead it's, oh, she's waiting for you. What the fuck was that?
Yeah, I agree that line, I mean, like, I think what they didn't intend it to be a romantic line. I think they intended it to be like some sort of some other kind of a love line, not like, you know, you're gonna go and live there and you're gonna have babies together, but more like, hold on, hold your face. Hold your face. Jeez.
Sorry. Jeez.
Decor is just going down the hill on this show. No, I'm just kidding. I may be wrong on that. My bigger issue with that part is so much of this movie is, as Rachel pointed out, about Coop and his daughter, about their love and their relationship, or, you know, the good and the bad of that. Mostly it's about the bad, at least until the last moment, and then they kind of, like, reconcile, sort of. My bigger problem is they have this moment in which she's dying. You know, she's, like, a bazillion and a half years old, right? She's an old lady, and she's dying, and he goes to this room. And he's Coop, like, he's her father, right? And she's got a bunch of kids, and they all look at him like, who the fuck are you, dude? And nobody, like, says, like, oh, you're Coop. Hi, I am your great-grandkid. Or, like, you know, hey, I'm your grand, like, whatever. Like, none of that is had. It's sort of the moment between them. She says, like, no father should see their child die, and you should go. It's that moment for me is not enough. And I realize the movie was almost 3 hours at this point, but that there needs to be more. That moment was not enough for me. Given how important their relationship is for so much of the movie, I feel like there should have been like Coop wakes up on the space station, and then he meets his daughter, right? She's still alive, but she's dying, and they have like, you know, they do some sort of like quick shoot through a few weeks of them spending time together. He's meeting the other family, maybe make him feel like he doesn't quite fit in because he's like 40 years old, but he's actually 150 bazillion years old, right? At least build up that tension so that it's more of a realization that as she's dying, she says, you know, I don't want you to be here because I don't think you should see me die. You should go to Brand because she's going to need help, right? You don't belong here anymore. You're not part of this world. At least them give that sensation, because I think that's what they were going for, but it wasn't enough to get the impression. So, Paul?
Yeah. So, anyway, there's a visual which kind of undercuts this whole Brand needs help bit, and that's Brand burying her lost love. And I was like, oh, great. So Interstellar is really about a long time widower's dating service. So it's like, come on. It kind of reminded me a little bit, and it does. And this movie doesn't own this whole relationship. It reminded me of the end of the Forever War. I'm certain at least one of you've read the Forever War.
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Finally, a reference everyone gets. So, I mean, at the end of the Forever War, we have Mandela's wife on that time shuttle waiting for him, and I can buy that because we've seen them go through the entire book, having a relationship falling out back again, and for her to wait for him, that's fine. But for Brand, okay, now I've buried my lost love. I'm going to wait for I need Cooper. It's like no, fuck no. It's like, come on, you've done decently in this movie, and you're gonna throw it away in the ending. Gah.
Yeah, agreed.
I mean, I can also see the symbolism they're going for there. I mean, you have Cooper and Brand as the parents of a new humanity, but okay, if you're gonna go there, even if you go do that, and that's fine, then build the relationship through the movie rather than having her push him away at every possible point throughout this movie.
Yeah.
Then I could buy the Adam and Eve, Brandon Cooper on the new planet with the babies. They're going to help build a civilization. Maybe they're the ones that become the five-dimensional beings. Who knows? That'd be fine. But the movie doesn't set this up in any way that they're going to have a relationship at the end. They just get one. It's kind of like pairing the spares in romantic comedies where you have the main leads mm-hmm. go off and then you have the other two. Oh, let's go get together. And
yeah,
without any sort of build up or any sort of justification of that.
Yeah,
I'm raging. I've done raging now. I'm
okay.
Fine.
Good.
My toilet works.
Well, look, we are almost at 2 hours on this podcast. Should we maybe just do final grade and close it out? I mean, I think we've hashed out quite a bit.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right, Rachel. Final thoughts and final grade.
So just, you know, despite the flaws, particularly in the third act, I mean, the movie is fucking gorgeous. It was incredibly ambitious. It had so much meat to it. We managed to talk about it for 2 hours, and I'm sure we could talk about the movie longer than its running time, probably. I fucking loved this movie. And actually, I'm not a huge fan of Matthew McConaughey, but he sold it. Like, they're, you know, when I sit back and am shampooing my hair in the shower and have the distance to nitpick, there is a lot that I can nitpick. But when I sat down and I watched this movie and I was in it, it was a cinematic experience that was, you know, transformative, really. Like, the last movie I watched that hit me this hard was actually Her for very different reasons. And then before that, it's been years since I've seen a movie like this. And her, obviously Interstellar and Her are very different movies and with very different scope. Anyway, so I loved this movie. I loved it. I'm in love with Chris Nolan and he owns my soul. So I'm going to give it an A- just because it gets the minus for, like, love is just as valid as, my feelings about love are just as valid as science, or, you know, scientifically. Rah!
Okay. All right. Mike?
Yeah, the visuals are astonishing. The soundtrack was very powerful if overplayed. I loved running around in space. I loved the robots. But for me, there are too many failures and too many things that don't work for me along several axes. And therefore, I'm going to give it a B.
Yeah, we can't be friends anymore.
This happens every episode, Sean.
Yeah, no, this is the end of our friendship.
All right. Yeah. Bye, everybody. Beep.
Yeah. Yeah, I just can't. I can't do it. I can't keep this sham up, Mike. Our love is not as strong as we thought.
Our love cannot go across time and dimensions. All right, Paul?
Okay, so I love the visuals in this movie. It's a science fiction movie, and even given the whole love crap, it's a solidly science fiction movie. The second act, even given the water planet, is wonderful, and I could have spent 5 hours in act two. Act one goes on a little too long. Act three has its problems. But I saw this on an IMAX and paid the extra money for that, and I don't regret a single dollar of that. I will buy this on DVD and watch its gorgeousness, even given its plot and characterization problems, which are problematic and make me want to rage as I just raged before. But so
rage
I am going
the
to
dying of the light.
I am rage against the dying of the light. Yes, we get into all that part anyway. So I'm going to split the differences between Rachel and Mike, and I'm going to give this a B+ because I think it's not quite an A. It can't quite get to that A. The time dilation is too severe, but it's a movie that most science fiction fans should see, if only to talk about it, and we've talked about it for 2 hours.
Agreed. I think I should end not talk about why I like the movie and give me a break. I should just read some Dylan Thomas to y'all. Yeah? No?
No.
No.
It's in the film, right?
Not all of it, only part of it. All right, fine. I won't read it. All right, fine. In any case, Dylan Thomas.
You left the gravitas of Michael Caine.
Do Not Go Gentle into That Good Night is quite prominent in this film. We did not talk about it. I love the use of that, though. I thought that was a great interpretation of the poem. But in any case, my final thoughts. There are no time paradoxes. It is a beautiful film. I loved it. The second I saw it, I was blown away. I had shivers after I saw it at the IMAX, and then I went and saw it again earlier this week because I loved it too much to just leave it alone. I had to go see it again. I actually, now after this, want to go see it again because it was gorgeous, and I'm glad that it has made a profit and that they're going to give him more money to make more science fiction movies, because God knows we need more Christopher Nolan movies that do science fiction, because he is probably one of the few directors who does science fiction movies that are actually science fiction movies that aren't, like, dumb.
Yeah.
You know? And, like, yeah, I get that some of his movies aren't as successful. They kind of flop a little bit. But if you gave me an option between watching another Christopher Nolan movie, flaws and all, or, you know, a Michael Bay Transformers 12, I mean, I would watch Christopher Nolan doing a movie about an orange floating in space for 3 hours. That's all it's about. It's just an orange in space. I would watch that over a Michael Bay film.
With a dead wife.
Oh. Yeah.
No, it's just an orange. That's it. That the whole movie is about the angst of
it's
modern.
It's just an object in space.
Yeah, it's an object in space, but it's about the angst of modern intellectual culture, and it's just an orange floating in space for 3 hours. It's Christopher Nolan doing an experimental French film, you know. Yeah. You know, once in a while, the orange would smoke a cigarette.
that makes it French.
And then it would be in black and white.
Yes. It would alternate between black and white. Because, like, you can't have it floating in space in black and white. That would be really confusing. But, you know, alternating. But in any case, I'm giving the film an A because I just loved it. I think it's beautiful. Also, Michael Caine was really good. That death scene? That was intense. So, I hope that it gets a lot of Oscar nods. It won't, because the Academy hates science fiction movies and they're bastards. I hope Matthew McConaughey gets an Oscar for lead, but he won't, because the Oscars hate the science fiction. So, makes me very sad. But in any case, that's it. So, if you have thoughts on Interstellar, you can leave comments on the website. Details will be at the end of the episode. Yeah. So congratulations, guys. We did it.
Woo! All good ending.
Cool. All right. All right. Thanks, guys. And thanks, Rachel.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Bye.
Don't quit me, Sean.
I have to quit. I have to. I want to be a big city girl, man. No. I wish I knew, like, romantic comedy lines I could just spew at you, but I don't.
Cause work on it.
We'll work
just
on it.
Tell him that you wish you could quit him.
I wish I could quit you. Anyway, and thank you, Paul.
I'm behind the books in your library even now.
When you say that, that's super creepy.
Oh, so it's God. You and not the cats.
All right, guys. And on that note, awkward ending and scene. We're done.
I gotta come up with some funnier shit to say.
Well, I figure that.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google Plus.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.